to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome to Elliot, who is going to talk to us about openness today. Elliot came to us via Wendy, who is watching in the ceiling right now, so I'm sure I'll relay some questions over IRC, if she'll have some. And he is a fellow communications at Johns Hopkins University and a distinguished research fellow at the E-Business Research Center at Penn State University. So,
thank you for coming. I should say that those academic titles are like Liberian flags of convenience. They allow me to talk in, as if I were an academic. Mostly, I just try to understand these things a little bit more. I came to this question about openness in part just because of the increasing digitization of information and the spread of the internet, and trying to understand what that meant and how it was affecting different kinds of institutions and different kinds of domains. And so what I'm going to talk about today is the fruits of that. And rather than sort of waiting for questions at the end, if people want to interject questions, I'm fine with that as I go through. And I hope I'd encourage you to ask questions and the like, because this is a work in progress. And it's a work in progress because I've come to see openness as a way to understand the impacts. And I'll try to show you what I mean by that, because openness in itself is not self-explanatory. So I see openness as a continuum, as opposed to a kind of binary, things are open or things are closed. And if you had an idea and you kept it under your pillow or something, it's closed. It's not shared with anybody. No one has access to it. No one can do anything with it. All the way on the other end is, let's say, the World Wide Web. If you put something up on the World Wide Web and you don't make any claims about it, and anybody can use it and do whatever they want with it, that's open. But there are lots of things in between. And proprietary software is closer to the closed end of this. Open source, I don't put at the open area. And while that's a matter of some dispute, I see open source as, in its kind of practical application, as something that benefits enormously from the qualities of openness. But in the end, when someone has to make a decision about what things go into the next Linux kernel release, there's a judgment that's made about that. And so it's not entirely malleable in the way that you might think about some other information products. So the interesting thing for me is to try to see, A, where things go on this continuum, and B, why you would want something to have a particular set of characteristics about openness. What is the appropriate degree of openness for a particular question? So, as I said, openness is not binary. There's a continuum. I see really two dimensions as the way that, at least for me, works in trying to understand what I mean by openness. If information is not available, or if the restricted availability or restricted access, then it's less accessible and therefore less open. But it's more than just being accessible. If I went to a cable system and I looked at the webcast of the city council, I could see what's happening. It's transparent, in the words that are normally used about processes, but I can't do much about it. I can't do anything. I can't make it work differently. I can't force them to do this or that. I can't take the products and do this or that with it, because it's not necessarily responsive. If information can be modified, repurposed, redistributed, if I can do anything I want with it, then it's more open. And so this questions about accessibility and responsiveness are the dimensions by which I try to make evaluations about openness, about processes, and about information, about systems. One other point that's maybe worth making, I see openness as clearly impacted by the developments in information technology, but not necessarily a product of those things. They're not necessarily things that have to be digitized. At least in part, as an attitude. I did a piece on healthcare and openness, and I was trying to think about how you would characterize a doctor. Now, that traditionally doctors had this kind of godlike quality. You do what I say, he tells the patient, or she tells the patient. You do what I say because I understand what's wrong with you, and I tell you what you have to do to make yourself better. The research on how docs and patients interact suggests this very tiny window of time by which a doc begins to make decisions about what's wrong and what should be done about the problem. And the difference, I think, in that openness potentially brings is a much greater willingness on the part of the doctor to do either listen more carefully to what a patient says about the condition, or to take more time to observe what the patient does, to see that potentially now, given that about a third of the people who come to primary physicians bring an internet printout of what they've researched, to see them as a research associate or something, it's a different way of thinking about the ability of many people to contribute. And open source helps us in seeing that there can be lots and lots of different people who have good ideas. We can't specify them in advance. We have to find ways of getting their contributions and evaluating them. But it's not necessarily a product of IT. And while openness has a kind of morally charged term, I think most people would say, I'm all in favor of openness. Openness is not always the right answer. So let's take an electronic health record. I want it to be open enough so that any doctor who treats me has access to all of the materials. I want it to be open enough so that if a laboratory result is produced, I want it in that record right away so that the docs can see it and I don't have to duplicate those tests. I want it open enough so I end up in an emergency room where I've never been before, being treated by someone I have no contact with, they can have access to this history. That's all the qualities about an electronic health record. On the other hand, I'm not crazy about the idea that my insurance company or my government or my employer would have access to this record. So it's not something that I want to have entirely open, but I want to have some of those characteristics for a certain purpose. I want it open enough to do those things, but not open so much that other people who I don't want to have access to it have access to it. So the purpose, the context are very important in thinking about what's the appropriate degree of openness. Openness is also not without a kind of very high cost in that we have more and more access to information. And that I think by and large is directionally correct. It's a good thing. On the other hand, it places more and more difficulty with trying to evaluate what that information is, to find good information, to know how to make decisions about the information, to know who was providing it, what was their purpose, what are the biases they bring, what are the underlying characteristics, how do I make judgments about this increasing amount of information to which I have access. So this work began from some questions when Napster was at its high point. When public policy folks were trying to say we've got to close things down, we've got to be able to give creators more control over this material so that that piracy doesn't erode the incentives for innovation. We see this kind of discussion of the first creator, the kind of American love affair with the idea of the genius inventor. All of these things are important to try to think about why we are where we are and why we have continued to give first creators more and more control. We extend the terms of copyright. We have more and more concern about enforcement. You have all of the notions of three strikes and you're out, you're disconnected from the internet, all in the theory that we have to provide greater control for the first creator so that they have the appropriate incentives to create. The problem with that is that there are first creators and there are follow-on creators. And by and large, every first creator is the follow-on creator for somebody else. And by and large, follow-on innovators outnumber first creators. So if we give the first creator more control, we essentially reduce the room, the area in which second creators, follow-on innovators, can operate and can contribute. Similarly, if we sort of gave all of the power and control to second creators, follow-on innovators, there'd be less incentive for the first creators. Now, the economic literature doesn't tell us very much about how much control you need to give first creators to have those incentives. And we are operating in some ways on a kind of value system that says, well, we're sure that the innovation comes because there are these incentives, and so we'll give them a kind of temporary monopolies to allow them to exercise control. So our intellectual property rules are built on this notion that we give people a temporary monopoly so they have control, so they can monetize innovation, they can be rewarded for it, and they'll continue to innovate. The more control we give to first creators, as I said, the less control comes to the follow-on innovators, the less incentive comes to follow-on innovators. Now, to give people control is generally expensive and imperfect. DRM is a kind of example of that. Imposes costs on the use of materials. It's hard to, it makes things that would be reasonably easy to use more difficult to use. Going back to the older folks here, remember toggles, when you would have a toggle so you couldn't duplicate software on your machine. People then started to say, I will pay more for this piece of software if I can make a copy. I don't want to have a toggle here. I don't want to be able to be restricted in what I do. And it's imperfect. It doesn't work perfectly. And so there's always going to be this copy floating around. There's always going to be a way of moving around this control mechanism. So if we wanted to give people perfect control, we're deluding ourselves. We can't do it, and it's expensive, and we're not sure how much it actually means in terms of greater innovation. If we flip that over, and we learn from open source and other forms of openness that employ the same kind of intellectual property licenses, the only difference in the open source license basically is that it says you can't control it, you can't restrict it. We want to get everything out as far as distributed as far as possible, so we can maximize the contributions that can come from others. So that it's the mirror image of this value creation. Whereas one says I have to have control so I can monetize and therefore have the incentives. The other says if I distribute, if I prevent people from restricting it, I'm going to get value from the contribution of others. And the wider the sharing, the greater the openness, the more potential value from those follow-on innovators. Now, it has some attractive economic characteristics because modifying, copying, and distributing things are cheap, much cheaper than trying to build in DRM. But you have the problem of this kind of question of evaluation, of being able to deal with the contributions that come in. So this issue of evaluation in this sea of information, or the finding the needle in the haystack, is a problem associated, at least in my view, with openness. There are lots of products of openness. All of you guys know this stuff, Wikipedia, Public Library of Science. I was really interested in the work that I was doing in healthcare on openness in clinical trials. There's a big debate over the last 5 to 7 years about who has access to clinical trials and the information underlying them. The drug companies wanted to have access only when they had reached a point in clinical trials where they were filing with the FDA. There was a rule that the FDA had established which said that you had to register your clinical trials if it was potentially life-threatening. And the debate was, when do I have to register it? Eventually, partly from the pressures from journal editors in the medical field, eventually people started to register their clinical trials when they began. Now, clinical trials have several stages. The first trial is really exploratory. The drug companies were resisting even any disclosures about clinical trials to later stages. But imagine if you had some life-threatening result that's caused you to stop a trial at the end of stage one or in the middle of stage one. You'd never know that that trial had taken place, and you would never know what the result was. And the argument was that I don't want to tell anybody because I have competitive advantages of starting these and not disclosing it. So this notion of how do I deal with competition, how do I deal with disclosure, these kind of tensions about openness were played out in the clinical trial arena. Eventually, the rules became you have to register it at the beginning. And there's something called clinicaltrials.gov that has that list. And there's now, under the WHO, a global pattern of disclosure of clinical trials. But the other part that was really interesting about clinical trials is what happened when they failed? What happened when they didn't accomplish what people wanted to accomplish or hoped would accomplish by testing this drug? One of the interesting products of openness is this Journal of Failed Clinical Trials, because you learn from failure. It's not only that you learn from success. And it was the kind of thing that openness produced to be able to have access to the information for trials that did not end successfully, but produced information so that people wouldn't repeat the mistakes. The latest work that I've been doing was on thinking about openness in the context of higher education. And it was peculiar that higher education was affected less by openness than other areas that are information rich. Think about entertainment, think about finance, enormous changes, fundamental changes in the way those industries and sectors work. Higher education, not so much. And there are lots of different reasons why one could hypothesize about that, but it is, I think, there are opportunities for institutions of higher education to make fundamental changes in the way they do things. And I would expect that there will be increasingly effects of openness in higher education. One of the reasons it's difficult to talk about openness in higher education is because of the differences in institutions. It's easy to think about openness at Harvard as a research institution where people can make statements about making research available to everybody. It's harder to think about openness in the context of community colleges, of certifying institutions, because they have different processes, different needs, different student bodies, different goals, and they're not thought about as much as by people in this audience as are the research universities which produce the people in this audience, I would expect. So thinking about openness in the context of teaching is much more broadly applicable, I think, than what I'm going to talk about a little bit later with respect to research. And the most interesting thing, I think, about openness in teaching and learning is the development of open educational resources. Those are those materials that are freely available for anybody to use to be able to modify, repurpose, to customize, personalize, to change for language, display vehicle, for the particular kind of student body that or student that is going to be using it. Open educational resources, I think, will have a much greater impact over time, with the likelihood that, in fact, those teaching institutions will be affected by openness in ways that they are not right now. There are lots of issues about open educational resources. They exemplify the potential of greater openness, but most open educational resources have been supply-side driven. I want to put a course up on the web. I want to make it available. So I do it and I share it, and that's great. But it doesn't say anything about who's using it, and we know much less about what happens with it than the fact that we have 5,000 courses on the web. That's great, but we don't know what's going on with it. And it's not driven by customers and learners as we would have in other fields. It's hard to evaluate materials that are constantly changing. One of the beauties is that you can modify them. One of the difficulties is let's say you do something that's really terrific and someone modifies it, it can destroy it, or it can make it better. So knowing in this chain what's good or not is a problem. It's hard to know over time how OER will develop because of the incentives for participation and use. It's not clear what are the benefits that one gains from doing it other than the feeling of making a contribution to the community. I don't want to downplay that as an incentive, but it's not one of the issues that it comes up about openness and open educational resources is it sustainable over time? And that usually depends on resources, and that usually depends on some good reason for deploying resources in this area as opposed to any other area. There are also problems with intellectual property rules and licenses. I'll talk a little bit about that later. And the issue there, there are multiple systems of open educational resources, whether it's OpenCourseWare at MIT or Merlot or Connections. They're not at this point really interoperable. You would like, in the best of all possible worlds, to have materials that are produced to be open and available, to be like Java, to be able to have it written in one place and made available everywhere and made interoperable so that people don't have these kind of learning curve problems of doing it, and so everybody can see what's there. Also, ways of then sharing evaluations and comments and improvements would be a lot easier if there were this kind of interoperability. And we're still learning in many ways how to collaborate in this area of creating educational resources. I want to back off one step from OER because of the nature of digital materials, of which OER is a subset. And one of the things that's happening that seems to me very exciting is work that's done at CMU and others, which was to kind of take digital materials and really harvest the advantages that they have. And the principal one, in my view, is that the potential for more immediate feedback, for assessment, for real-time learning for the student, for the faculty member, for the creator of the educational resource, for the learning sciences community, is inherent in the digital materials. And we're only starting to use those well, to design those well, and use them to be able to take advantage of that. There was a proposal, and there's some work being done right now at CMU aimed at community colleges to produce materials like this for community colleges, which I think is a kind of brilliant use of the capability of the materials. But we need to kind of, I think, keep producing this, because you really can deal with what's called keystone courses, for example, courses which are used by a large number of students. And there happens to be, and one looks at sort of course enrollments, a relatively small number of students, a relatively small number of courses that are taken by a large majority of students. And if you got really first-rate materials available for these areas, and if you were able to kind of harvest this kind of possibility of assessment and feedback, I think we can make learning outcomes much more satisfactory in places that have not gotten the attention or the support or have the resources that are available in more well-endowed institutions. But there's lots of work that needs to be done on educational outcomes. What are we actually trying to do? What are we actually trying to accomplish? And how people are moving toward that. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. There also is lots of work that still needs to be done on comparative effectiveness. A meta study came out of the Department of Education this past year trying to evaluate face-to-face education, online education, blended education. And the meta study says blended education is the best possible education, and we need to be able to figure out what are these best practices and the best ways of accomplishing that now that we have the opportunity to use these materials and to work online at a distance. We see the possibility for openness in lab experience, fab labs, kinds of ways in which people can harvest the kind of opportunities to tinker. I always thought that it'd be wonderful to have fab labs used based in areas with high unemployment, where factories are being closed and where machinery is available, and people who know how to use that machinery can help other people tinker with that. We're seeing much more in terms of online substitutes for hands-on clinical and other educational experiences. The open science movement is trying to make more materials available to broaden access to good science. So the lab, we have to find better ways to provide these hands-on experiences or quasi-hands-on experiences at a distance to people beyond those in the developed world. It's much easier to look at openness in research and to see the impact on research institutions. For me, the seminal moment was the Human Genome Project. On one hand, you had Celera and Craig Venter, a brilliant scientist who said, I'm going to kind of tackle the genome, and I'm going to then rent out my findings to people, and I'm going to hold on to them and the like, on one side of the race, and on the other side, Francis Collins and the Human Genome Project saying, you guys, as soon as you discover it, I want you to put it you want to publish it and make it available to everybody so that everybody can build on it. And there was, to my view, a kind of mediated result at the end where people said, hold up both hands and say, we all won, we've got the genome decoded. But the model changed in research, I think, at that point, to people saying, this is the way to go. And there isn't really, I guess, that I've seen a major collaborative research activity in the biosciences that isn't following that model now. And it's a different model than we used to have. And I think it will continue to gain in power because people are seeing much faster rates of innovation. We're seeing the rise here at Harvard, MIT, some other places of digital repositories so that people have access to everything that's produced. And that's a real change from the situation where the only way you got it was via somebody's subscription, your own or somebody else's in a library. Open access journals are really changing the notion of the model of publishing and challenging the proprietary models in ways that have forced the proprietary models to change the way they do business, whether it's making back copies available electronically or shortening the embargo periods or having different relationships with faculty. What's a kicker in all this is that the ways we've recognized research accomplishments in the past, which are at major research institutions, is this published in Nature? Is it published in Science? Is it published in the proceedings of X, Y, or Z? Was in some ways a kind of had the feeling of outsourcing recognition, that if you had a major paper in a major journal, then that you were certified as having accomplished something, as having done good research, and you would be rewarded. If, however, you publish the stuff that you do immediately, if you disclose it immediately, if that becomes the model, then it's not possible at the moment to say, well, Nature published this, because Nature won't publish it, because it's already been published. So how are we going to make determinations about whether this is worthy research that should lead to rewards, whether it's grants or tenure or what have you? We don't have good models yet of how to reward in an environment in which immediate disclosure is an attractive model for research. And we need to understand and to find new ways of peer review and evaluation as digital scholarship becomes more and more important. And there have been some work done in this area, but I think we're still a long way from it, from doing it successfully. And the major places where one gets funded haven't necessarily found a new way either to make these judgments. They having to rely on different ways of getting peer evaluation. But this is an area where, over the long term, we've got to find a solution to this recognition issue. For, as I said earlier, the questions of intellectual property and the like have gotten in the way of a number of developments, including those in open educational resources. The existing rules about use of materials in classrooms by teachers are limited, which give considerable freedom to faculty and are limited to traditional classrooms. But if you think about how open educational resources and digital materials online are being used, they're not necessarily going to be used in traditional classrooms. We've got to find a way of broadening that, or the process, a very expensive and time-consuming process of clearing rights, will inhibit the development of new materials. So there's a kind of fundamental change that needs to get done in terms of this restriction, and to take the educational exceptions that exist, intellectual property law, and broaden their application. We need to kind of recalibrate the balance of intellectual property rules to take to recognize this question of one value system versus another, of focusing only on the first creator to one that's more balanced and saying, this is what's necessary for the first creator, but this is what also will encourage the use of the development of innovation by follow-on innovators. Bayh-Dole, which was a piece of federal legislation in the early 80s, was designed to get federally funded research out of the university and into commercial application. And there was some good reasons for thinking that this was necessary, because universities were sort of sclerotic about disclosure, and there was not much interest in how people use the products of federally funded research. So Bayh-Dole was probably a necessary correction for the existing structure. But now what's happened is you've got 3,000 licensing offices at universities around the country, And they're all kind of working on a what I would think of as a kind of lottery attitude toward the intellectual property that's produced, the fruits of research. They're all hoping that they will be like the University of Wisconsin with stem cell patents, or the University of San Francisco or Stanford, the University of California at San Francisco or Stanford, a kind of lottery that if we only can have the big score, then we're going to be able to sustain the university and everything will be good. The problem with that is it encourages people to have the most exclusive licensing regimes, because that's the way they get the most money in the licensing of the research. And that's not necessarily A, consistent with the mission of the university, or best for science in general or research in general, which would encourage you to disseminate more broadly. It's particularly problematic in areas where, for instance, the fruits of the research may have life and death implications in areas where people can't afford access to drugs and the like. We've seen this with HIV/AIDS and other medicines, and we've seen some useful models from Yale and other places of saying, yes, you can have this license, but there are exceptions in the exclusivity for medicines in this area so that people can afford the drugs that they need to live. We also need to think carefully in this world about access to orphan works. We see this in the Google Books discussions and Google's plans to be able to digitize materials and make them available. The way Google and the publishers had structured their agreement, orphan works, which were works where you couldn't find the rights holder to be able to get permission to use it, those works would only be available, basically, to Google to be able to digitize. And those orphan works constitute a very large percentage of the published works in the United States and elsewhere. But in the United States, it's sort of reasonably easy to identify. It's a very big chunk of work that would be taken out of the broad access and limited to Google having essentially been given the rights as part of the settlement by the publishing community. So orphan works is a kind of fly in that agreement, and I would expect that the discussions, that the eventually the decision by the federal court that's looking over the proposed Google book settlement will try to broaden the access to orphan works. Openness is not only useful in thinking about teaching and research, but is useful in thinking about other missions of the community, other missions of the university. Yeah.
There's a really important one, and it's likely to get settled in the next few months in a way that we may not want. So you're hoping that the judge will make the right decision about increasing access to orphan works. So I guess I have a question about what that would look like in the settlement, and also whether how confident you are that relying on the judge to do the right thing in the settlement, or there's been talk about legislation. In fact, I think there has been legislation to deal with orphan works coming up through Congress.
Right.
So what would you favor? What's your, you know?
Legislation, I think, would be preferable. Because you know it's a crapshoot with how the judge deals with this. I think the better part of the argument suggests that what he should do would be to make them more available, put everybody on an equal footing who wants to digitize these works, and essentially construct a settlement that looks like legislation, which would be to say that anybody has access and having a kind of takedown provision, which would allow the rights holder to come in and say, no, I don't want you to do this. Take it down. I'm like, but I don't have a high degree of confidence simply because the way it was structured makes me, the way the agreement came into being makes me uneasy. You know, in some ways, in the law, you would think about this as a kind of collusive settlement between Google and the publishers, all of a sudden speaking for all authors everywhere, and now it's been narrowed down. But the orphan works are, by definition, not at the table, the holders. So,
In particular, the settlement had language that's since been modified,
right,
or proposed to be modified, I guess, that made it virtually impossible for anybody else to start doing the spanning.
Right.
spanning? That's not right. Scanning. There, that's what we call it. To engage in a similar project.
Right, right.
The deal originally said that the publishers and authors could not cut a deal with somebody else
right.
without offering the same deal.
Right. And so it was a bet. You know, it was the offer that you made now to the successor had to be extended back to Google.
Yes.
So why would anybody enter into that agreement?
Competitive advantage.
Right. So and that was a kind of evidence in some ways of how collusive this piece was with respect to other parties. And I think the judge has taken notice of that, and certainly the pleadings have pointed out that problem. And there, because the legislation gives you at least a working model which you could apply there, but remember that it's a settlement that the parties have to agree to. So if the judge says, no, I don't accept this, then you're going back and you sort of, in theory, come back to the judge again and say, well, how is this settlement, and keep chopping down this salami until he's willing to say, I give, or they're willing to say, we back off, and we'll end up in court in a different way, in an infringement suit, as opposed to in this proposed solution. Because I'm a policy wonk, I'm always hopeful that policy can emerge that's sensible. I'm often disappointed, but here I think there is a way of getting at this. Legislation would make it not the province of an individual judge in these contesting parties, and everybody having to file amicus briefs to be able to do it. So. But it's a major problem in the settlement, in the proposed settlement, and it's a major problem in how do we think about similar kinds of things outside of this particular domain.
Sorry for the interruption.
So what happens, this is being webcast. What happens if you think about every symposium, every kind of public event in a university, with a default condition being you make it available electronically, as opposed to where it is now, I need to make a special request to have somebody come in to make this available. I have to go through all these hoops to make it open, as opposed to having it closed. Closed to the members only, closed in that only the members of the university community have access to it. That's, think about the effect on the local community of changing that default condition. So just a way of thinking about openness in a non-teaching or research setting. Openness in terms of what kinds of software are being used administratively. We've developed over the last 10 years a fairly vibrant community of community source software being used in universities for course management purposes, now increasingly for those sort of the guts of the university's function, registrar functions, accounting functions, and the like. So we can do things like that. We also can start to think much more creatively, I believe, about support services and what can be done online to make things easier for people to do what they need to do to be able to stay in school, to be able to complete school. The number of people who have difficulty in the populations that are least represented in our universities and colleges, the difficulties they have in dealing with financial aid applications and the like, when we could do much of that, the help for people online, when we can think about tutoring online, support services online, peer-to-peer activities to help people, where we have good models from the Open University in the UK and others, where you can see the success that's come from the support that's available to people online. We haven't, I think, even really touched that in the United States, and we could do much more of that. Another area tied to the research area that we just talked about is the change in the way we think about access to governmentally funded information. There was a long fight. I mean, it's been years and years and years and years that people were pushing to have NIH funded research to be made available. And finally, in 08, NIH issued a policy that would make NIH-funded research available within 12 months to everybody by being filed in PubMed Central. What was interesting is the publishers that had been the usual folks to make this stuff available came back and convinced now the head of the Judiciary Committee in the House to introduce legislation that would overturn that. They haven't sued for infringement, although they say that they, the charge is that the NIH policy is in violation of copyright law, but they've persuaded some people to try to overturn that. On the other hand, there's now a much stronger lobby in the U.S., and the administration has taken the position that it, in fact, should be extended to these other intramural research funders. There are about 11 agencies that fund over $100 million a year in research, extending that policy. And there's legislation being proposed that would extend the policy and shorten the embargo period to 6 months. But this is still a fight. It's not at all clear, although I think the odds are in favor of legislation passing and these things being extended, whether by legislation or by executive order, so that this material gets out. But we can think even more broadly about this, both in terms of underlying data and data at the state level. Underlying data, for instance, would be the kind of data that you file for clinical trials when you ask for approval for a drug or a medical device. That information now is not available to people, even as the process goes on and as a drug is approved or a device is approved. The provisions in the application treat that information, the clinical trial data, as trade secret information. So you file it and no one has access to it for years after that because it's a trade secret. We've seen over the past 5 years a number of examples where close examination of that trial data indicates where there are potential problems and where the matching of the trial data with subsequent adverse events has called into question A, the clinical trials themselves, and B, the efficacy and safety of drugs and devices that have been approved. But people haven't had access to the data in general. And if you extend the public access policy not only to government-funded research, but to research that is provided to the government in exchange for a governmental benefit, in this case, the authorization of a drug or a device, you could see that there could be greater benefits of increasing access to information. As I said, another thing that would be of marginal impact, but still useful, is for the funding agencies to start to think about including money in grants for those people who apply for it so that research could be published in open access journals as opposed into proprietary journals, because most of the models of those journals are essentially the author pays for publication. It's a reasonably trivial sum, but it makes it easier to imagine that people will use open access journals, and it provides a kind of path to sustainability for open access journals in addition. The last piece I want to talk about is openness and transparency in degrees and courses themselves. What's pretty interesting, at least for me, is how little we know about what the meaning of a degree is and how hard it is to try to compare a degree other than kind of reputationally. How do I know when someone gets a degree from someplace or a certificate from someplace what it means? How do I know what the educational outcomes were that were sought? How do I know how people have progressed? How do I know what people know from this experience and what they can do with it? And there is very little transparency in this and very little comparability. And we have seen a model in Europe, in what's called the Bologna process, that was driven by the EU common market. Once they establish the common market, you can imagine people moving from place to place and looking for jobs and looking for admission to other institutions, and they have a degree. Now, how do I compare the degree from a university in Germany with a degree from someone in Portugal and with a degree from someone from an institution in Italy or Greece or what have you? And there is a process that they've gone through which is trying to harmonize the meanings of degrees so that people could know, as they say, what someone can know and can do as a result of this, so that employers, other institutions can make judgments about this. We don't have that right now, and it makes trying to understand what happens to a person as they move through a series of educational institutions pretty difficult. And if you thought about making this more open, if you thought about increasing the kind of intentionality about an educational experience, what am I trying to accomplish? What do I need to do to help people accomplish that learning outcome? How do I measure whether they've accomplished that learning outcome? All of those things would be useful to be able to be available for people to make judgments about what someone has done. Looking at the educational outcomes are also a way of thinking about students, potential students, making judgments about where they want to go to school, where they want to get their educational experiences. Right now, imagine if you didn't have a network of people who could advise you, relying on U.S. News and World Report to say, this is where I want to go to school. A series of essentially input measures, how many books, how many faculty, what's the, you know, what's the reputation by from other places. If that's the way that we choose institutions, it's a pretty ineffective way of making a market for higher educational experiences. And we can do better than that. And if we start to think about trying to harness information to help make, to allow students, people who pay for education, employers, to make better judgments as a way of increasing the productivity and effectiveness of those of institutions, the only way they're going to be able to do it, like any other good, is if they have good information. And right now we have accrediting institutions that say, you have met some minimum requirements to be accredited, basically, so that you can offer federal aid to education, federal aid to your students. That's not a way of getting continuous improvement in those institutions, and not only is it not a way of getting continuous improvement, but it's aimed at the institutions themselves, not the people who, the students or people who would make choices about institutions. Accrediting agencies say they don't want to share the information. Only about 19% of the accrediting institutions say anything more about the institutions they accredit than you're accredited or not accredited. So you've got 80% of the accrediting bodies don't give out the information that they gather as they supposedly evaluate these institutions. Because they say, yeah, I'm sorry.
Of things. And when you mentioned U.S. News and reports, they have specific measuring instruments that they utilize in order to make determinations as to how they rank schools.
Right.
And it seems as if that everyone agrees with their instrumentation. As a different take on it. And when you spoke about, I'm not as familiar with the technology you were talking about, the orphan technology, but when we use Google as an example again, what they use with the Droid, that platform they give away for free. They give away the Droid software to everyone for free with the hope that they come back and they actually just get used to the Droid platform, and I guess they would update or upgrade the equipment or the software to do different things later on. But how do you compare what's already out there commercially to what you're arguing about as being on the academic mission side?
Okay. I think the first premise is one that I would disagree with. I think that within the academic community, there's little agreement about the use of the present ranking systems, mm-hmm. because they don't essentially rest on what happens to people as they move through these institutions. Mm-hmm. There are a whole series of criticisms about how they make these judgments. But fundamental to it is that they tend to be input measures as opposed to output measures. What you would really like to know is, if I went to this place, will I be changed in a way more, will there be more positive change in me than if I went to that place? Now, that's a very hard judgment to make, and I acknowledge that. But it's not, it's unlikely to happen if it's simply, say, there are this many faculty to this many students, which is a kind of an input measure as opposed to an output measure. The kinds of the measures that seek to judge quality have tended to be reputational. So I send out this survey and I ask who thinks this is a good place and how would you rank this place? Now, A, that tends to get gamed. There's this wonderful example of someone who ranked their institution number one and everybody else numbered 214. So that the measures can get gamed, but even so, it's not. We would like to know, I think, more about what the experience has meant to the people who participate in it, and to know that.
Just to contribute to that, I think so much of the practical curriculum at universities has changed today, like the University of California and even Carnegie Mellon. They have it that is mandatory now for students to study abroad for either a semester to a year. So not only do they have a theoretical background in their education, but they have a practical application with theoretical background in learning in the classroom. I think that's what's changed the most. But the only reason I was asking is because I was, while thinking of those things, I was trying to think of the new instrumentation or the different instrumentation that you'd be referring to in order to make this work with more transparency and choice and more measurable after, as you said, at the result, at the end. What are they walking away with? But I see a lot of schools changing their curriculum so that students actually do walk away with something that's practically measurable. They can...
Sure. And this is, I mean, this is not going to be perfect by any means.
Sure.
The question is it better than what we've got now? My argument is right now you have something that we don't know what the degree means. We don't know how people are measuring what's happening to people there. We don't have a way of making judgments about the experience as a whole. Mm-hmm. And if education, and I'm a big fan of higher education, if education is like any other process or product, you'd like to know what happens, you know, what's going on, what difference it makes, and to give people some better information to make decisions about what they want to do. And so transparency in this case and access to information is really important. Yeah.
So a couple of things that this example brings up for me, and I think for me this actually extends into, to any extent I'm going to offer a critique of the talk so far, but first, it seems like you're conflating two factors here. You're conflating openness and you're conflating the change in inputs and outputs. And I agree with you entirely that, you know, evaluating through something along the lines of the U.S. News and World Report, essentially you're looking at inputs and somehow saying, we've got more books in the library than, you know, our rival across the river, and therefore we're better. And in fact, no one's actually gone and done that. And it would be sort of fascinating if someone were doing something else and essentially saying, let's look at Harvard students and let's look at them 5, 10, 20 years out, and maybe we evaluate on income, or maybe we evaluate on happiness, or maybe we evaluate on social impact. But, you know, that would be a different way of doing things. But that's actually independent of doing it openly. And yes, having an open, more formal standard to sort of say, this is how we rank what our degree means versus another degree, that's one thing. But sort of comparing whether or not a university is an appropriate place for another, that seems like something where you could either evaluate based on inputs or outputs, but I'm not sure that the openness is the critical ingredient.
Okay. For me, where openness comes into this is access to information. Mm-hmm. And putting aside the question of comparative rankings, the fact that, for instance, the accreditation system has information that they, in theory, are evaluating institutions on, which is not shared and not available, is the openness question.
So when we look at the U.S. News and World Report ranking, in many ways what we're doing is we're making a closed ranking on open information. The universities are publishing the vast majority of that information.
Right.
There is an algorithm that changes over time, and they rank in one way or another.
Right.
It's interesting, when you go more open in some of these spaces, there often end up being massively unintended consequences, and to draw what may be an inappropriate parallel, there's a lot of discussion about what it would be like to have an open search engine. You'll note that no one's really done it. And the reason that no one's really done it is the moment you put forward an open search engine, you've essentially created a game for spammers to get the top of it as quickly as possible. So Wikipedia made a pass at this and very, very quickly backed down from it, because it just turned out to be a disastrously bad idea.
Right.
What works really well for Google is to have a lot of information, some of which is open and some of which is not so open, and to have a completely closed, impenetrable, secret sauce algorithm.
Right.
And so where I was really excited about your talk was you started by sort of saying, yeah, no, not everything needs to be open. You know, there's a continuum. But as you've gone on, you've seemed rather relentlessly for the open. I would love to push back on things like, what are the unintended consequences when you take campus events that people expect are default closed and blow them open? And I say that mostly because that is where we're going anyway. We've just watched Facebook go from being, it's never been open in the sense of Libre, right? It's always been closed in that sense. But it's gone from being semi-private, semi-safe spaces to being blown open by default, and by open I mean like open like my windows, you know, so that you can see me getting dressed in there. And there are some real objections to that version of open.
Absolutely, and if I sound like a true believer through this, it's only because directionally I think this is important as a way of improving higher education, but not because I think that all openness is better than all and anything less than that. I think it, as I said earlier, it depends, right? The guy named Henry Geller used to be the general counsel at the FCC, and he said there's only one question, and the one question is compared to what? So openness is compared to what in the particular setting? The example you give of Facebook, I think, is a very useful and illuminating one, as is the question of an open search engine. You don't say that openness is always right, but universities have been kind of exemplary in their lack of transparency, and so directionally, it seems to me.
What I worry about in this critique, though, is that you make a very, very reasonable argument beginning in a fundamental change in intellectual property, and I agree with you entirely on your framing of an overprotection of first innovators versus second innovators, which very quickly turns into, here's where open is coming in many, many different places. I don't disagree with you in that arrow, but I do think there's a way in which it's not hard to misinterpret your talk
Fair enough.
As being an endorsement of this. And where I tripped for the first time was the openness of university events, because my instinct is to say, yeah, that's great, let's open everything up. And then I'm actually remembering being 17 years old and loudmouthed and stupid. I'm still loudmouthed and stupid. I'm no longer 17, and I have slightly more control over things. But I thank God those things weren't open. And I'm now thinking in the context of being a sometimes educator. And while I see a completely rational argument for why we should go there, I also see sort of vast unintended consequences that go with it. And I guess that's the roadblock that I'm trying to throw in the talk.
I had a very similar reaction to it. And leaving aside the education part, because then we might be here all afternoon arguing about that. I have a lot of problems with that, but that's a separate issue. Thinking of it as a historian, as I am, it seems to me that your directional arrow is just too one-dimensional, right? So that throughout history, it seems to me there have been lots of examples where openness and closeness work hand in glove, right? So that the patent system could be looked upon as a closed system allocating property rights, but it's also a system for forcing innovators and companies to reveal what they have. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, it's been used precisely for that purpose by second-order innovators, mm-hmm. even though there's a property rights issue. Right. Now, of course, you can talk about how long the property rights should be, and that's not a trivial problem, but nonetheless, the closeness of one system is the openness of another. The closeness of the medical example, the classic one, right, the closeness of a professional body that can deliberate among itself, knowing that someone else isn't going to be listening in, provides a kind of openness that might otherwise be lacking if there were total transparency. My ability to walk down the road freely and not have to look in the open blinds of someone else's bedroom, you know, is a kind of...
Right. That's not only openness that I don't want, you don't want it either. Trust me on this one. Yeah.
So, I mean, it just seems like the kind of open versus closed sometimes doesn't capture...
But
it either comes out as unintended consequences on one hand, or this kind of interaction, you know, if you open up education to the kind of transparency and measurements, and you are talking about measurements, not just, it's not a neutral process. You have to create a system of measurement, and you have to, you know, that becomes a kind of set of values as to what education is. You also have created now a new source of authority, which are the people that determine what the measure, the community that determines what the measurements.
That's right, and so let's go back from there to your point. I think you both are right in saying that openness is not some supreme value over all things, and I agree with that absolutely. And I've tried to make that clear, and if I haven't, sort of I make it clear again that I think it's situational. I think it really depends on how it's applied, what you're trying to accomplish, and the like. So if you take the patent system, you're right that it forces to disclose, and that's a very important piece. You'd have to say, is, so when Beth Novak tried to deal with prior art and to get a community that could supply information about prior art for making determinations about patents, I would argue that that was making the system more open. It didn't change the fact that an examiner was going to make a recommendation about the patent or the terms of the patent, but it made more information available for that examiner to make a better decision. So is that process now more open? I would argue yes, and I would argue that it was better. Not necessarily changing anything about the process of granting a patent, but making more information available. So that's more open for me and better for me. Does it mean that I'd want to do away with the patent system? No, but I would like to improve it, and there are a number of ways in which people have argued about how to improve it.
Sure.
But in that sense, it's making more information available and therefore trying to improve the process of decision making.
Right.
With respect to how one thinks about an authority about measuring the accomplishments or the educational outcomes of a particular class, one can say, we're going to leave this all to the atomistic faculty. That's fine. That's where we are now. I mean, an individual faculty member says, this is what I want to accomplish. This is how I'm going to do it. But the intentionality is, I think, and I think experience would demonstrate that that's correct, is that you could make it better if people sort of try to articulate this in a way that people can, in fact, discuss this, make sure that students can say, this is what they're trying to do. Oh, I understand now better what you're trying to do. That seems to me not a question of another authority, but even in that, if we left it simply to the faculty member to make that clear, that the interaction between student and faculty is improved by people trying, by both parties knowing what people are trying to accomplish. I would in fact stand by that. I would in fact say that there may be improvements in trying to get a larger group of people to be talking about what the outcomes might be of an Anthro 1 course versus a set of faculty members saying, I have this view, I have this view, I have this view, I have this view. But that's one where people, you know, fight about the autonomy of faculty, about the whether or not we can in fact determine what's better or not, how to measure it and the like. My own view is that making more open those sought outcomes is better as an educational tool than not. Does it say that you have to take my view about it? No.
Right.
But again, in each one of these, I would argue that there are things that you might